Who are you?
Why'd you have to start with such a hard question?
Because I can't let you off the hook. Everyone gets the same question.
I would say I am a daughter, a sister, a partner, a wife, a caregiver to my mother who has Alzheimer's disease. Also a cancer survivor and someone who deeply cares about where we're headed with humanity in the future of work.
I love that. I can feel that. I mean, that one comes straight from the heart. I can feel that. Where are we headed, Jen? Where are we headed?
If only we knew, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think there's a lot of predictions. I don't know if any of it will come true or not, or we're going to find out.
Sure. What's just for, you know, obviously everyone that, you know, or for those who don't know you, because you and I have met before and so forth, have, you know, consumed your book and whatnot. What's the quick version of how you got to this place that you're at right now?
The quick version is someone who believed that my value and worth was tied to my professional title, to my output, to the metrics that we track in the workplace, and that was very miserable and extremely depleted until the point of burnout and having to rebuild my life and really think about the role that I wanted work to play in my life, you know, with work continuing, and it still is today, an important part of who I am and what I do, but it's not everything. And sometimes I think that is a daily battle for me to remember that, you know, that's a piece of who I am, but it's not who I am.
So. It's funny. I got that. We were chatting before we hit record and I mentioned there's been quite a few events and, you know, speaking and so forth over the last few days. And a few people asked me something to the effect of, like, do you still have to have mental fitness practices in place? And like, do I still have to? If anything, I probably have more. And this is why I do this work.
I think we do this work because we need it more than anyone else,
totally.
Right?
Totally. I actually do believe that. At least for me, it feels true. If I stop for a day, I mean, look out, the mind just starts to spiral. So
I had a psychologist researcher tell me once that that they call it me search. So instead of research, they call it me search. And so most of the time they get into this work and into this field or into whatever, you know, they're researching because it's something that they're struggling with themselves. And I think that that's absolutely true for me too.
Yeah. So before writing Hope and doing the work that you do today, professionally, what were you doing and what was life like?
Yeah. So I spent 23 years of my career at Deloitte. The last 10 of years of my career there, I was the firm's first chief well-being officer. Some people will say that I was the first in the world. I don't know that to be true. Can't validate it, but I will say I was one of the first in
the world. You were early, that's for sure.
Yeah. You know, but before becoming the chief well-being officer, and people often ask me, you know, how did that come about? And it goes back to what we were just saying, out of necessity. You know, before that I held, you know, several different roles within the organization. And one of them being the chief of staff to one of our previous CEOs. And while I advocate for anyone that wants to be a chief of staff, it's a great role, but it's a role that in many respects is all consuming. And someone else's goals and someone else's success becomes your goals and your success. And so for me, I was young in my career. I think I very much got lost in that and not really defining what I wanted out of it or what Jen Fisher's version or vision for success looked like. And any of these very large, high-performing organizations, I don't think that that's uncommon. We just tend to kind of look outside of ourselves or look around the organizations or look around societally and point to what we believe markers of success are. And most of them are external markers of success.
Yeah.
But we don't do the inner work to say, well, is that really my definition of success? And I was certainly never taught that, you know, having a thriving life and hobbies and friends and, you know, that was never on my vision board of, you know, of success, right? It is now.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and so that's, you know, I kind of got lost and, you know, ended up in a place of depletion and burnout. And, you know, for me, I did seek out professional help, clinical help through the help of a therapist. And that's when I learned about hope and the power of hope. I actually had a therapist who had me read C.R. Snyder's work. C.R. Snyder is kind of the godfather of hope and hope theory, and do hope exercises. But I would say up until that point, I probably never even thought about hope. It was kind of like this whimsical, you know, why are we talking about hope? There's no metrics associated with that, although there are, but just a complete fundamental misunderstanding of what hope is and what hope was at that time. And so I think in redefining who I was, who I wanted to be, what success looked like, and how powerful those hope practices were for me in recovering from that.
Sure.
It became, you know, just part of how I live my life and who I am, and certainly part of my leadership ethos. And for those that can see me on screen, I wear a hope bracelet on my wrist every single day, because, you know, I'm sure we'll get into it, but hope is another one of those things that's hard. You know, hope doesn't guarantee success. Hope makes you recognize reality, what sucks,
for sure,
before you can move forward. And so there are days where I'm like, yeah, this hope stuff feels really heavy. Why am I doing this?
Yeah.
But it is incredibly powerful once you start to understand it and embed those practices into your life.
I have a red bracelet, which is to signify as well. It's just to remind me daily as well. And more than daily, I mean, I would say in the moment around, you know, just putting my mind first is why I wear that. Before we get, because I want to go a little bit deeper into hope and your book and the practices and the perspectives around that. But before we go there, I do want to stay a little bit around the idea of a chief well-being officer. And I actually got a few of these questions this morning from executives in the health sciences space and like massive companies. And I got the feeling like they don't have a role like what you were doing and so forth. So some of the questions that came up in that talk were around how do we set, you know, if we want to set personally boundaries for ourselves and, you know how we, you know, what's required, I guess, to show up as the best version of ourselves personally and professionally. But then if we have leadership teams that maybe aren't on that same track or aren't prioritizing that, like, how do you get that going? Right. And I think if you have a chief well-being officer, I mean, that would be at least the first place to probably have a conversation. Yeah. But if you don't, like, I guess, what do you see out in the real world where, like, how do we have more of these conversations so that, you know, we're not burning out? I mean, because the data is not good. I mean,
it's
terrible. And it's still, like, I know you mentioned there's metrics around hope as well. And there's so many around well-being, but it seems like it doesn't matter or something, right?
Yeah, it's you know, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because I think the conversation that I've been having a lot of with my colleagues in the field, and, you know, I'll just start by saying I do think that there needs to be a chief well-being officer in especially every large organization.
Yeah.
I realize that for small and medium organizations, maybe that's not realistic, but there should be somebody who is looking after, the culture that is being created and our, you know, the ways in which we're working and the things that we, our behaviors as leaders and colleagues, are we negatively impacting people's well-being or are we not? Are we positively impacting people's well-being?
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think that is the role of a chief well-being officer. It's not necessarily about, you know, do we have the right programs and tools and resources? That's table stakes.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, what is our culture telling people, you know, either, you know, spoken or unspoken, what it takes to be successful here? And are those things, you know, are those behaviors and the results of those behaviors hurting people or helping people? More often than not, right? Like, work is work. You know, there's going to be times at work when you're giving more to work because you're under a deadline or you're meeting a milestone or whatever it is. But I think the awareness and the acknowledgement and the conversation, the psychological safety, the ability to say, hey, you know, this is what this is and it's going to end. But if at any point during this time you're struggling, you need more time, you need to set boundaries. Those are the types of things that I believe a chief well-being officer should be have a seat at the table. And those are the types of questions that should be asked. Somebody that's a true advocate for how work is impacting people. The question
and that's
around
different than HR, right? I mean, I know HR, obviously there's I can see overlap, but there are so many other responsibilities as a head of HR or whatever it is that you can't possibly take on all of.
You can't, right? So, I mean, people will say to me, isn't that the job of the CHRO? I think most CHROs would tell you that they agree with all of the things that I'm saying, but like, do not add another thing to my plate.
So
I think at least most CHROs that I talk to are like, if you can come in and fix this for me, like, please do. I think you made a really interesting point about the data. The data's not good. The data hasn't been good for a long time. And so I think, unfortunately, I think for a long time, leaders were like, well, show me the data. I need to see the data. I need to see the data. And we didn't have, 10 years ago, we didn't have the data. We had some data. We didn't have the amount of data that we have today. But showing the data, I think what we're doing is we're mistaking data or substituting data for strategy, right? And so we just kind of keep admiring the problem and admiring the fact that the data is bad, but we're not really doing anything to move the system or change the system. And so we keep falling back into, the same old behaviors, which gets us the same data. At this point, I mean, there are a lot of people that will hate me for saying this, but we don't need another study. We really do not need another
study. I agree. I put data up this morning, Jen, on the slide, and I kind of made fun of it, but I'm like, obviously, if your mind is in a good place, there's going to be less stress, more productivity. Yeah. And then now there's like wicked data around profitability and sales and so forth. But like, almost like, obviously, right? Like, do we really need to see this?
Everybody knows this, right? Like, we have been, you and I and so many others have been talking until we're red in the face. And so, but I still think, and maybe that's because you and I talk about it all the time.
Fair.
Because conversations that I have with leaders now is really, a deep concern. Like, I have yet to meet a leader that tells me, I don't care about maybe they're not going to tell me that because I am who I am. But nobody has sat across from me at a table and say, like, I don't care about the well-being of my people. Like, I don't care if they're struggling or suffer. I mean, on a very human level, I don't think anybody wants that, But there are so many competing priorities around kind of what falls on the desk of these C-suite leaders, which is another reason why you need a chief well-being officer, because you need somebody whose sole job is to care about this.
Yeah.
But a lot of them also believe that they're doing a lot of the right things. They have invested in programs. They have enhanced their benefits. They give their people resilience training and they give them the latest app and all of these things. And in their mind, they've done what they can do or what they should be doing. And so then the conversation is, that's great. Like, that is table stakes. That's where you need to start. But a meditation app, as great as the meditation app was never meant to and is not going to fix, work overload, work overwhelm. Like, it's just not, we can meditate. We could be the best meditator in the world and maybe we'll handle stress a little bit better, but it's not going to clear my plate of all the work that I have to do.
Yeah, totally.
So then it becomes a conversation of like, okay, well, let's look at the things, the work related things that are actually causing people to have bad well-being outcomes. And how do we chip away at what those things are? A lot of them are related to work overload, too much work, overwhelm and stress. A lot of them are related to, mattering. And do I have good relationships with my peers, with my colleagues, and in particular with my boss? Does somebody care about me in the organization? Do I believe that to be true? Am I valued here? There's a lot right now on that, as you know. So those are the kind of human conversations, especially in the age of AI that we need to that we need to be having. And when it comes to hope in particular, I know there's a lot of commentary out there of like what AI can and can't do, but I can guarantee you, because I've tested it, AI can't hope.
Sure.
And it's not even good at helping you hope.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, so let's talk a little bit about hope. And it's interesting because I wrote down, this is your book, obviously, hope is the strategy, which I've actually, and I'm sure you've gotten this before, but normally we hear the opposite of that, yeah. right? Of like, yeah. do everything to make sure that hope is not your strategy, right? Or hope isn't a strategy is yeah. the line I've heard most often. So how did you come to that language? And I guess where does hope fall into your world in terms of how it helped you kind of get out of the scenario that you found yourself in?
Yeah. Love that question, and fully anticipated that that would be the top question that I get when I published a book called Hope is the Strategy. And it was intentional. For anybody that is listening that knows me, they know that I like to push back on societal and organizational norms that don't make sense.
Yeah.
So the reason that I say hope is the strategy, I didn't say hope is the only strategy. I said hope is the strategy because I think most of us have dismissed hope because we've heard hope is not a strategy or hope isn't a strategy. And so we just don't understand it. I certainly didn't understand it. So, you know, I think that when I hear somebody say hope isn't a strategy, to me, I'm kind of like, well, that just represents a fundamental misunderstanding of what hope is. And so if you look at the research around hope and what C.R. Snyder and others have said about what is required for real hope, it is a very thoughtful, self-aware way of actually setting and pursuing goals. And so that's why it is a strategy. So real hope requires three things. It requires a goal, which has to be specific and attainable by you. So it can't just be some pie in the sky, like, hey, I won a lottery ticket and I'm going to sit back on the couch and win the lottery. I mean, maybe dumb luck sure. would have that happen for a few people, but not for most of us. The second thing it requires is the identification of multiple, they talk about them as pathways, multiple ways in which you can accomplish that goal. And why it's more than one, multiple pathways, is because oftentimes when we pursue a goal, we run into roadblocks, we get stuck. And what happens? We give up, we throw our hands up, we get frustrated. If you've already identified another pathway in which to reach that goal, you're like, okay, cool, that didn't work. I learned something. Let me switch to this other pathway and continue to pursue this goal. And then the third thing is agency. We hear a lot about agency, especially in the workplace when it comes to engagement and culture, but the ability to actually affect change, like to do something to move towards that goal. And in that regard, that's what makes hope and optimism different. Optimism is the belief that I can make change. Hope requires you to actually take action, like identify yeah. that action and start to move on it. And so therefore, if you translate that into life, but in particular, organizational life, it's very strategic.
Yeah, it's not wishful thinking.
It's not wish. And what I tell leaders is like, hey, you have this incredible transformation strategy, whether it's organizational transformation, AI transformation, whatever you're transforming, because every organization seems to be transforming everything right now. Like you've yeah. laid out this incredible transformation strategy. The one thing you haven't done is actually thought through how you're going to get people on board. How are you going to get people to see themselves in this transformation, to believe that what you're doing is going to make tomorrow better than today for them? And that's what hope is, you know, thinking that like what I do is going to make life better for me. And until you do that, you're going to struggle with mm-hmm. your transformation. And it's playing out main stage right now with AI right? Like everybody's uncertain. There's tons of uncertainty. There's tons of like, nobody is clear on what AI is really going to do versus not do. People in their organizations are being told you have to use AI or you're going to get fired, but they're not telling them what to use AI for yeah. or how.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like main stage right now. And I'm sitting here going, if you had a hope strategy, like if you had sat down and thought like, how am I going to get people on board with this? What are the goals going to be? What are the pathways? How am I going to give them agency to move towards this at an individual level? Then I think we'd be seeing it play out very different. So that was a yeah. long way of saying why hope is the strategy.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. And the details make perfect sense. And I think the only thing I'd love to add is just, because this is where our work is so complementary, it's that while you're taking that time to look at the hope strategy, also looking at like, what does my mind need and what do the minds of the teams need to actually thrive in this new environment or whatever's coming coming up, or whatever transformations are in the plan, because right now, and you, again, we've talked about the data, right now, people aren't doing well, and they're working at, or their minds are working at like 60% at best from the data that I see through some of these blueprints that we have. I mean, how can you possibly expect the team to see what others can't see and you know, come up with a strategy or path that is, you know, cutting edge and a competitive advantage when it's, you're literally just trying to get to the end of the day, right? I saw a bunch of check-ins again this morning and over the last few days, just seeing what's on. And these are like high performing leaders. These aren't, you know, the people that aren't, you know, responsible for massive amounts of decision and profits and all of that. And it's so consistent. It's like you said, a bunch of AI uncertainty. It's like the questions I hear, like, how do we cut through the noise? Like, how do I make better and slower decisions? And my mind feels completely full, right? And I don't know. I just look at this as different than like any of the business strategies. If we had data coming back like that, we would change the business strategy or make some adjustments.
I've always said that, you know, I mean, right? like well-being, all of the thriving, all of these components, if your financials came back and you were operating at, you know, 40% of what your capacity or potential is, I mean, shareholder value would be in the toilet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yet it's okay for that same, you know, for the data to show around well-being that, you know, more than half of your workforce is struggling. And I mean, I think that that's it. And that's where I kind of get to the things that we do at the individual level are critically important, and we need to continue to do them. We also need to start to address the systemic issues that are creating the environments in which we're, you know, the things that we do to thrive as human beings on an individual level are being systematically undone. Every time we log on to our laptop, walk into the office, walk whatever environment that we're in, right? And so, you know, and so it's no longer like, I mean, I think when I was experiencing burnout, I really, and I think so many people still do, I really processed it as, well, this is a personal failing. Like there's something wrong with me. There's something that I'm not doing to take care of myself, to thrive in this environment. And while some of that is absolutely true, when you have 60% of your workforce that is experiencing, you know, depletion, burnout, struggling with their mental health, that's no longer an individual problem. Like all of those people can be doing the exact right thing and still not be thriving.
Yeah.
You know, and so we have to complete this. It's not that one is wrong and the other's right. It's just that we have so heavily said it's the problem of the individual. The organization bears no responsibility, or the leader bears no responsibility for the culture or the environment that we're creating. What I tell these leaders is keep investing in these incredible programs. And let's enhance the ROI by also chipping away at the organizational norms and behaviors that are no longer serving you.
Yeah. So, but if someone's listening to this today, I mean, hopefully, you know, if you're a leader or you're running a company or in the C-suite and you know, this is some kind of food for thought to have some different conversations and explore this topic, then that would light me up. But for someone that maybe doesn't have that level of authority to make change at that level, any suggestions on, you know, hey, I was listening to Jen and Mark talk about this topic. Like how does one, because I keep hearing this out there as well. Like, how do I bring this forward without, you know, seeming like I'm complaining or I'm not grateful or what, or you know what I mean? And just make sure people take it seriously and actually lead some change.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And it is one that keeps coming up. And I think because a lot of people are struggling with it. I think first, you know, I go back to psychology, right? Like focusing on what you can control, right? I think we often get caught in the, and this is your world, kind of the thinking and mind traps of like, well, I can't do anything about it. You know, that's that, you know, it's us versus them, right? That's on them, right? And the things at the systemic organizational level, you might be absolutely right, except for we tend, if you're anything like me, we tend to continue to obsess over the things that we can't change.
Sure.
Because we can't change them. So it's kind of human, right, to do that. But then we get stuck there. And that in itself will wear you down. So identifying, and this is to me why hope is also so powerful, is hope will tell you what's the next step that you can take. And then the next one after that, like you don't need to identify the whole plan. You don't need to identify the next 10 steps, but what's within your control and what's the next step that you can take? You know, and you had brought up boundaries earlier. Is it, you know, just setting a boundary where you log off two times a week, you know, at 6:30, because that's when your family has dinner and you don't log back on, you know, and see what happens. Do it one night a week if you have to, or, you know, log off from 6:30 to 9:30, whatever the small, whatever you think is the smallest thing that you can do to show yourself that the world's not going to come to an end.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, because we catastrophize. Like if I don't respond, we tell ourselves, if I don't respond to my boss in 5 minutes flat, then they're going to think I'm less committed. They're going to fire me. They're going to, and in a time of extreme uncertainty, none of us want to be that person that is seen as less committed or complaining or, but I would also say we all work with other human beings. You know, you have a friend at work, you have two friends at work, you have two colleagues. You know, bring it up as a like, hey, how do you, you know, like, what are you doing to take care of yourself? What are, you know, like, what's working for you? Can we create something where we can support one another? And what does that look like? Yeah. You know, how can I hold you accountable? How can you hold me accountable? What can I back you up on? What can you back me up on? So start really small. You know, when I talk about system change, what's interesting is when you think about the biggest transformations of our lifetime, they, when we watch them on TV or in a Hollywood movie, it makes it seem like, you know, one day everything was this way and then we all went to sleep and then the next day everything changed. But that's not true of any big transformational systems change, right? It was a whole bunch of people doing a whole bunch of little things up until the point that it was no longer little, and then it affected and impacted change. And so I think we have to remember that even though sometimes we feel powerless, we are part within an organization or with any type of community, we are part of the system, and we either contribute to, you know, bad behaviors within that system, or we start to, in small ways, push back on those and start to change our own behavior, which then changes other people's behavior. So that's what I say to people that feel like they can't make large organizational change. Change what you can change. And that often starts with you.
Do you remember one of your, and whether you can name the client or not, it doesn't matter, but do you remember any of your first, maybe handful of clients, or maybe even the first one, where they got what you wanted to do and what you wanted to bring in, and you're like, yes, finally someone's like seeing the full picture here? And like, I guess for you, like what helped them see it?
Yeah. You know, I think I'll actually reflect on the creation of the role as chief well-being officer. So not even kind of one of my recent clients since I left Deloitte, but, you know, being inside of one of the world's largest professional services organization, which, let's be honest, isn't necessarily known for, you know, this is a easy, carefree place to work. You know, so I thought, so the timeline goes, you know, I experienced burnout. I had to take a leave of absence. I came back to work. I sat down with my boss. I was actually in the marketing organization at that time. I was working for the CEO, and then I came out of that role. And I was in the marketing organization struggling. And that's really when kind of the burnout, it had been happening all along, but kind of when it came to a head and I needed to take time off. And when I came back to work, I sat down with my boss and I said, I'm going to resign from the organization because I, you know, want to focus. I want to create a career that's focused on helping others not get where I got. And it was her vision, actually, more than mine. My vision was this needs to happen externally outside of the four walls of Deloitte, because there wasn't a role like that at Deloitte. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea that I could build or create that role. And she said to me, you're not going anywhere. And I was like, what? Like, you can't tell me I can't quit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What do you think I'm going to do? And she said, if you need this, there's a lot of other people that need it too. And so she kind of created talk about pathway. And she was, I talk about hope dealers, people, leaders are dealers in hope, right? I mean, talk about the ultimate hope dealer. She was the one that cleared the path and created that pathway for me to at least put together a business case for well-being at Deloitte and what a well-being leader or a chief well-being officer would look like. But even then, I mean, I think I got very lucky because the CEO at the time and the head of HR, both of them understood inherently the connection between well-being and high performance, because that was how they lived their life. They lived it very quietly, as many did at the time, right? I have it figured out for myself, but I'm not going to tell you, because if I tell you, then I'm going to be told that I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. The secret meditators out there.
Yeah. So I was very lucky that I got a lot of support at the very senior levels, where I got a lot, and I wouldn't even say it was pushback. I think there were three buckets. There were the people that just absolutely did not get it and didn't want to get it. Then there are the people that absolutely got it and were like, yes, we've been waiting for this. Please bring it on. And then there's that bucket in the middle of really good, smart, talented people that are like, I don't know how to do this because this is not what we've been taught. And so it sounds good, but what's going to happen if I let Sally go to yoga at 2 p.m.? And I'm like, nothing's going to happen because Sally's going to be done with yoga at 3 p.m. and nothing that you're doing is brain surgery. And so it's really just about like giving people permission, letting them know that they're supported, that somebody has their back, they're not going to get in trouble for these things. So for me, it was those conversations of like, just helping them understand, like, I know this isn't the way that you came up in the organization, and I know it feels really uncomfortable, but can you just try a few things and see what happens? And I tell some great stories, some great case studies in the book where this, where this happened, where people were like, wow, I did this. And like, my team is incredibly engaged. They came back to me with all of these ideas. We changed all these processes. I gave them a ton of agency and ownership. And now, everybody's performing better, feeling better, has more time off, more time with their family, right? And so it's really those moments of like just convincing somebody, can you just try this little thing? Try it for a month, try it for 6 weeks, and then report back. If it didn't work, great, it didn't work, no harm. So to me, it's always those, it's that or kind of the unexpected stories of like, hey, Jen, I heard you say X, Y, and Z on Mark's podcast, and I went and tried it, and let me tell you what happened.
Yeah. Well, and it all just compounds, and then there's a ripple effect. Then, especially in large organizations, then one department is like, "What's going on over there?"
Exactly. They want to know.
Spread, right?
Yeah.
Are you noticing any trends or any industries kind of present day that are picking up on this a little bit faster, that maybe we can add some fuel to those industries, knowing that they're already open, and then maybe to that point, then hopefully others see it and, we can keep that momentum going.
Yeah, it's a great question. I probably would like ask the same back to you. I do think the legal industry is actually doing quite a bit, which I've been really impressed with.
Another industry not really known for.
Yeah,
life.
That's what I was going to say. I feel like I have a soft spot for them because it's not dissimilar from the world that I grew up in management consulting. I think the same of, I think there's a lot of work still to be done, but I think healthcare realizes that they need to do better and be better and get better. And they're starting to take steps towards it. I wouldn't say that they are there yet by any means, but I think that there is a general, in my experience, recognition that the way we've been doing it is no longer the way we can keep doing it. And I think there's some real bright spots in healthcare, which is promising for all of us, because I don't know about you, but I don't want, surgeons and doctors and nurses that they're not completely well themselves.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I actually saw that this morning. Is the event I did was through a recruitment firm, Pender and Howe. It was just a breakfast event that completely voluntary. I mean, the room was full and they were, like I said, loaded full. There was general manager or VPs of departments and big, I mean, this was more healthcare companies and there was pharma, there was health tech and so forth, but just health in general, which was just nice to see that clearly the topic was of interest. And of course you could see that people were also struggling, but I think, you know, this is where, like, we need to stick together and have more conversations. And that group was super open with what they're struggling with. Right. And let's just normalize that, but then work on, well, here's some things that we can try. And here's how we can, at least to your point, first try it individually, but then share that with our teams and keep the momentum going. Like, we all win. That's the thing, right? There's no downside to having a hope strategy and a clear functioning mind.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know why it shouldn't be so hard, but for some reason it is. I do think, you know, maybe not specific industries, but I think, you know, at kind of the regulation and policy level in certain countries, you're starting to see some promising regulation around, you know, workplaces being much more responsible, especially around kind of psychosocial health and things like that, for creating environments that at a minimum aren't harming people.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
So maybe that's a place to start, right? We've reached rock bottom.
Yeah. Well said. Well, I mean, time is flying here. I'm going to start trying to land the plane a little bit, but I'd love to know for you personally, are there any questions that have been on your mind that have been helpful when, you know, you're trying to prioritize the health of your own mind or thinking of the future ahead that you've been, you know, if I had, you know, whether you journal or not, I mean, everyone's reflecting in some capacity. But if I opened up your journal and looked at some of the questions you're thinking about, what would those be? And what are some non-negotiables for you when it comes to your mental fitness?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, questions for me are really around, you know, the recognition that like most technology in our lives, actually like most everything in our lives, things can be used for bad and things can be used for good. And I do think that there are some really promising use cases for AI when it comes to the workplace, but I'm not actually seeing a lot of those play out the way that they should. And so I think the question I keep coming back to perhaps isn't a hopeful one, but, you know, at what point are we going to realize that, you know, laying off thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the name of AI is not a good strategy for society and humanity? Sure. And what is our responsibility to society and humanity? I think that bounces around in my head constantly, and I don't have an answer for you, although I believe that done well, AI can be a positive solution, whereas right now it feels very much like a negative answer to many things.
That comes back to bringing the human in the equation, right? Yeah. It's just like, what is the humanity aspect of, and individually we can all take on that question, even in the smallest of ways in what we're working on, and just have that kind of top of mind. And then I think we can kind of course correct
do we use AI to make us better, not worse, right? To you know, care more deeply about what's truly human versus what isn't. And right now that feels flipped. For my own mental fitness, I try to stay away from the news. Like, I try to stay informed, but stay away from the news. Mm-hmm. That's probably my number one right now. I am somebody that lives with anxiety on a regular basis. So, you know, sleep to me is a non-negotiable. I have a reputation of just disappearing regardless of where I am because it's time for me to go to bed.
I love that.
That is something I don't negotiate away. And moving my body, you know, whether that's getting outside on a walk with my dog or going to the gym and, you know, lifting weights. But for me, I've tried many, many, many things over the years for my anxiety. And I will say, you know, movement and exercise, when I'm not doing it, it's very apparent in how I show up and just how I feel about, you know, how I feel about myself. So I think those are, you know, some of my top strategies. I'm constantly reflecting or even potentially overthinking. There's a fine line.
Sure. I agree. I resonate with that for sure.
But yeah, all those things. But I would say staying away from the news, sleep and exercise are my top three.
Amazing. Last question for you. What, if you think of the future of the workplace and just our society in general, what has you hopeful?
I think conversations like this and, you know, everywhere I go, and maybe it's the world that I live in, but there are a lot of really good, smart people who do care and that are trying to steer the ship and in the right way. The other thing that has me really hopeful is young people. I spend a portion of my time on college campuses with young people. And I think every generation, we tend to be like, oh, they're so, you know, they see the world through rose colored glasses and they don't really understand how it is and whatever, you know, they're snowflakes or they're that, whatever it is that we call them. I think we've done that with every generation.
Yeah.
When I spend time on college campuses, I walk away and I'm like, first of all, we're handing them a world that's really hard. And second of all, they in no way are weak. They're in no way unwilling or unprepared to inherit the world that we're giving them. They are angry that we're giving them a world that's so screwed up, but they want to fix it. And they are not unclear about that.
Yes.
And they want to fix it in many ways in which we got wrong. You know, I mean, it's, you know, their views around work and hustle culture and things like that, I don't disagree with, you know. And so I think you're seeing some of that play out inside of our organizations in terms of, you know, the kind of the generations butting heads. Yeah, spending time with young people gives me a lot of hope. And I apologize ahead of time for what we left them to fix. But I believe that they can.
Yeah. I love that.
And I will sign up to help.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. No. We're definitely, you know, we're definitely out there helping as much as possible. But that is a beautiful message and a reminder. I think a good reminder that, because you're right, we all look, it seems like every generation does the same thing. And we don't look at the other side of that as well and what you're seeing. And I'm seeing it as well in some of the campuses I'm on. I want to just say thank you. I mean, of course, for making the time to come on the show, Jen, but I mean, a higher thank you for just dedicating a lot of energy and time to getting this message and your work out to as many people as possible and for, you know, writing the book and constantly showing up to change the conversation. I mean, I know I might be a little bit biased, but so I will say it's not easy. And there aren't as many people as you would think actually doing this. So I deeply appreciate what you're doing for us. And for everyone listening, please pick up the book. Hope is the strategy. Follow Jen. I mean, bring her in to your organizations. Like, let's continue these conversations and all help each other. And we all win when we do this. So thank you. Thank you.
Well, of course. I deeply appreciate that, Mark. And likewise, all of those same sentiments, you know, right back to you and the work that you're doing and, you know, for sharing so many other people's work in addition to your own.